and welcome to IEP Essentials Pro Tip Podcast, brought to you by Learning Essentials. I'm your host, Wendy Taylor. The goal of our podcast is to bring professionals together that support students with a variety of learning needs, to have a conversation surrounding the IEP process, and our goal of all of this is to provide the student and families with guidance to help make things easier with the IEP. So I'm really excited for our conversation today, talking about vision statements. First, before we get started with vision statements, let me introduce our guest, Annie Tolkien. Say hi, Annie.
Hi.
Annie is the founder and director of Accessible College. Her mission is to provide students with physical disabilities and health conditions and their families with support to ensure a successful transition to higher education. Annie was the Associate Director of Academic Resource Center at Georgetown University, and she has assisted undergrad, grad, and medical students with physical disability and health conditions with college accommodation process. And that includes providing one-on-one consultations to students experience academic challenges and working collaboratively with residential living to assist students with physical disability and health conditions who were seeking housing to meet their needs. And so while at Georgetown, Annie discovered that many of the students she worked with had not received transition supports to prepare them for the transition to college with a physical disability and health condition. So thus our conversation today regarding the importance of a vision statement really came to light in bringing Annie on to this podcast. So before we start, Annie, why the start of Accessible College, and especially what is the law surrounding students as they move into college? Because I think this will help kick off the need and conversation for our vision statements.
Yeah, absolutely. And Wendy, thank you for having me on. I'm really excited to talk about this with you.
You bet.
So I started Accessible College after working at Georgetown University for 6 years as the associate director of the Academic Resource Center, which is the disability support office at Georgetown University. And at different colleges and universities, the disability support office might have different names. So that's a number one thing that people should be looking at and thinking about. It could be called disability support services. It could be called access services. It could be called learning resources or learning services. And so there, I was working predominantly with students with physical disabilities and health conditions, but at Georgetown, it was a small office. So in a way, I really worked with all the students who were registered with the office. And when I say registered, it's important for students and parents to understand that the process for requesting accommodations at the college level is very different from what it is at the elementary and high school level. So once you move to college, the law that governs accommodations is the Americans with Disabilities Act, which is different from IDEA, the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, which is what governs K through 12 education. So when you're in the college setting, the role of the parent diminishes and the role of the student is very active. So the student is the one who has to go into the disability support office to follow that process for requesting accommodations. So they have to be the first one to take that step and go in and say, I need these accommodations. They have to provide the documentation. And the parent really doesn't have a role in that process. So I think sometimes that catches families off guard because parents are so used to having a role in the process during elementary school and high school, and they don't realize that their student is going to be the one who has to do these things independently once they get to the college level. So that's a surprise to some parents.
Right. And I think that kind of goes nicely in what we're saying, because when you talk about a vision statement, we're really talking about your child's future at an early age. So if you have a child that is in elementary school or younger and or at any grade level, and they are starting that IEP journey and having an IEP, and in that, and even kids that don't have IEPs, you know, what is your vision statement? Where do you see your student, your child in the next year? Where do you see them in the next 5 years? And so thinking about that future for that child and considering that time frame and realizing that vision statements will need to be updated each year as your child's challenges are changed or their goals have shifted. And so I think where it helps the conversation with Annie coming in is because as we have these vision statements for our child, we're having these discussions of what can they do. And so thinking in these big transitions, whether it's from elementary to middle, middle to high, or high school and beyond, what are their needs? And through that process, how do we accommodate? How do we advocate? How do we teach them self-advocacy skills? And so from that post-secondary, Annie, mm-hmm. why should you write those vision statements? And then how do we switch? I guess it's kind of a two-part question. How do we help our kiddos from that umbrella of our parents' guidance to when the laws do change in college and they are then now expected to be independent?
Yeah. And I, you know, building off what you were just saying, Wendy, I have kind of a two-part answer. So,
I love it.
So, you know, I think sometimes it's hard for families to take the time to think about where they want their student to be, especially if a student has a significant disability or a chronic health condition that's like a reoccurring condition that has flare-ups and kind of the day-to-day challenges can consume families, right? I mean, that's the reality of it. And so taking the time to sit down and think through where do I envision my child going? And for the student themselves, because once they get up to the high school age, that's about the time, you know, 9th, 10th grade, that's about the time we want them to start thinking about where do I see myself going?
Right.
Once they're in that high school phase, we really need to make sure that the student is already thinking about what do I want to do? How do I envision my life? Where do I see myself going? That doesn't mean they have to have it all mapped out, but starting that process of thinking through, you know, how can I get to where I want to be? Or how can I look forward to achieve what I want to achieve in the future? And that's where this process of having a vision statement can be really helpful for the family to think about, you know, what do I want to get to and how do I get there? And building off what you were saying earlier, this is also really an opportunity for families to sit down and say, okay, my child may not have all of the independent living skills or all of the independent, you know, self-advocacy skills and tools that they need to be living independently. So how do I start building up and scaffolding up? And the way that that kind of shows itself for a lot of students who have health conditions and things like that, or significant physical disabilities, or just other challenges in general, is that there are some things that you can do as a parent to start thinking about, can I give my child a little bit more of a role, you know, in the doctor's appointment process or in the medication management process, right? So thinking through, like, you know, how does my child take their medication? Am I giving them their medication every morning? Is there a way where we could start to, you know, either set out a pill box or use a different chart structure or a schedule so that the child can start taking their own medications and looking at managing their own refills and things like that? Because those are the skills that students are going to need once they're living away by themselves, either independently or once they're away at a college campus. And I think that sometimes families get so caught up in just like making sure the machine is running that we often forget to step back and say, how am I preparing my child for independent living and for being able to advocate and do things by themselves?
And I think that's an excellent point in terms of we get caught up in the machine. And, you know, and I know that I'm guilty of it as well. And, you know, I have a child with medical needs. And so it's really an excellent point to say, let's step back. And just even as part of what I do in helping families through that IEP process, encouraging that as well, even at a younger age, of what can we have the child do that's independent. You know, at a younger age, it looks very different than it does in what you're sharing. To add to what you just said, I think that's important too, is you're talking about taking pills and being independent at some point when we get older, but also can they make a doctor's appointment mm-hmm. on their own? You know, can our students type a proper email to their professors versus just texting, you know, and teaching those skills. And then, you know, and part of our vision statement when our students are in K through 12 is thinking those as well. What can we do independently? What skills can we help them advocate for? And that kind of leads me to my next question of, does the vision statement need to be realistic?
Yeah. So I think, you know, vision statements
is a big question, right? You're talking about children's and teens and young adults.
Yeah, I mean, I think it should be achievable, but it can also be aspirational. And what I mean is that the student may choose something aspirational in a sense that may take some work to get to that point, but that's kind of part of the process. So I also have a background in health coaching, which kind of guides my practice too. So when I'm working with students and families, I talk a lot about, you know, scaffolding and setting up achievable benchmarks so that we're meeting those benchmarks to get to where we want to be. And so I think to have something that's, you know, goal oriented in mind can be positive and helpful, but the student and the family might need to work through what are the steps that we need to take to get to that point, right? And so that's where I think some people miss that part. They skip over that section of like, okay, I want my child to achieve X, Y, and Z thing, or the student says, I want to be an aerospace engineer. And they skip over the process of thinking through, okay, so here's where we're at. What steps do we need to take to get there? How do we scaffold and build up? And that's where, if you're really engaging in this vision statement process, it should be a part of your process to sit down and think through, okay, what are the steps that we're taking to get to that point?
So because you can look at it as like a micro thing or a macro thing in terms of, you know, the regardless of the age of the student, in taking that team approach with that vision statement and really, like you said, being engaged in that process. Some students may need really micro steps broken down, scaffolded down to get to the level where they're shooting for. And yeah. Some may not, but it really is that individual, going back to that individual needs of that student and working with that family and really helping them through that process and engaging them, you know, so it is realistic, but also aspirational. And what can we do to blend those two and make it successful?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So with that, how should vision statements change as, you know, you talk about vision statements changing throughout time. We said, you know, that it should look at a year at a time, but also at 5 years. And so where your role comes in is nearing this exit of high school, mm-hmm. where it's just considered, you know, oh, this is our next step, but really kind of taking that microscope and saying, all right, what are the steps that they're going to need to be completely independent from me when they arrive on that college campus late August, early September?
Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things that's super important to do, and you just talked about it, was thinking about what is the best next step for that student, right? So looking at like the individual and the individual's needs. But, you know, it could be college. It could be a gap year. It could be, you know, a service opportunity. It could be a trade school. It could be, you know, community college. So there's a lot of options and opportunities. And I think this is why planning for that transition process should start a lot earlier than senior year,
right?
Theoretically. You can't see me right now, everybody, but my fingers are crossed. It should be starting earlier. Because if you wait until that last year, then it's triage. It's a sprint. And this is more like a ultra marathon.
Right.
So we want to be talking with our kids and thinking about these processes and starting these vision statements and thinking about what they might want to do next and what we might want them to do next and merging those things if they should merge before we get to that senior year process where they're starting that, you know, exiting of high school. Because what a lot of families do is they wait until the last minute and then they're trying to make sure their kid knows how to do refills, make sure their kid knows how to make the doctor's appointment. They're trying to put all that stuff into like 2 months of work when, you know, it would have been more sustainable and probably a lot easier for everyone involved if that process had started, you know, several years earlier on, so that your child can build up those skills and make mistakes, quite frankly. So your child can, you know, like not do it right one time and like see what that feels like or what the repercussions might have been. And then, you know, building up those skills so that they have a more consistent practice, because that adage of practice makes perfect is true. So like the more time and opportunity that the child can have to enact some of these things and to build up some of these skills, the better off they will likely be once they are living independently. And so, you know, thinking about how the vision statement might change as they're nearing the exit of high school, they might be thinking more broadly about what they want to do as a career or how they see themselves in the future. And so sometimes because of my health coaching background, I do vision boards with people. So we actually do cut out pictures of, you know, careers or ways they want to see themselves or using words. You know, parents might want to engage in this process, and there's a ton of resources online. You just get a bunch of old magazines and you take out a poster board and, you know, or a piece of paper even, and just make a
vision board. Your house.
Right. It's like, and it can be the same thing. It can be aspirational. It can be goal oriented words. It can be pictures, but when your student is nearing that exit of high school, you want to make sure that they have all the skills in place and looking at different aspects of their life. Because once they're on that college campus, you know, mom and dad aren't there to make sure that they're eating or make sure that they're bathing or make sure that they're doing their laundry. So your kid needs to have, you know, life skills in place to be able to live independently. And so making sure that they have those life skills is critical.
And those are really, I love all that. And to have that vision board in front of you to know what you're going towards. And it really provides that active exchange of thoughts and conversations and talking through what makes sense and what the likes are, what our goals are. And also, you know, I think bring in your child's IEP team. If you're uncertain, because sometimes I think as parents, it's hard to see the forest through the trees. So sometimes it's, you know, we don't know what we don't know. And so to bring in somebody, an outside source such as yourself or the child's IEP team to brainstorm with your team about appropriate goals for the child that are both, you know, that balance of realistic and aspirational. And so you can then work together as that team to create that vision statement.
And Wendy, as a part of your IEP process, once your child reaches high school, there is a section that gets added on for transition planning.
That's right.
And so theoretically, it's being completed as a part of the process. But I think a lot of time parents are so busy advocating for things for the here and now, right? So like you're so busy and caught up in figuring out how to meet your child's needs right now and making sure that they're getting the services that they need in that moment, that oftentimes that transition piece gets kind of pushed to the side or left till the last year, even though theoretically it's supposed to start much earlier on.
Transitional services and conversations are supposed to start, and having the child be a part of that IEP process is definitely encouraged even before that transition piece is put on the IEP. So any age that makes sense, a child can be part of that conversation much younger than the start of high school. And I think that's a really important part. I mean, to kind of piggyback on what you said is that in those IEP meetings, oftentimes we're looking at the little picture of those, you know, what can we do to make that child successful in the classroom throughout the duration of that school year? And it really is helpful to kind of step back and look at big picture as well. And I think having this conversation of the vision statement, starting that vision statement when your child is young, that when this transition happens and occurs, it really is seamless. That big picture has always been thought of, and the little picture is there part of those micro elements that we talked about earlier, but then to have both working simultaneously, right? So that we're talking about what can we do on a micro level? What can we do daily to help build these skills that we need for our child to academically, socially, emotionally to be successful, but then knowing what is our end game and not necessarily that transition into college and then it ends, but this is a forever process as we know as adults, as you know, in your previous experience as a health coach, that end game always grows with us and changes with us. But to have kind of both of those working together, I think really is beneficial to the individual child and really will help that conversation and help that direction for a family if they start that vision statement young.
Yeah. I mean, and this could be a good area too, an important area for parents to, you know, either bring in outside support or if the parents are doing it as a team to have someone who focuses on the needs now and somebody who's tasked with making sure that the transition supports get covered in that conversation. So, you know, there's a lot going on in an IEP meeting, no doubt about it. And so it's easy to lose track of like what's been covered and what hasn't. And oftentimes you're on a specific
There's also a lot of emotions and part of that IEP.
Yeah. And then there's also like time, right? So there's sometimes scheduled like back to back to back. So you have a finite amount of time. And so sometimes it can help to think about what your questions are prior to that meeting, right? To like write them out so that you're prepped going in there. So even if it doesn't get covered during the meeting, then you can follow up with the IEP team via email or whatever after that meeting to have that next part of the conversation.
That's right.
But yeah, I mean, it's just like going into a doctor's appointment, right? It's like a good practice is to write down like, what do we need to talk about? What am I sharing? You know, so that when you get in there, you don't lose sight of all the things.
What a perfect analogy. It really is. And we do the same thing going into a doctor's appointment. I'm concerned about these things and then follow up questions and then follow up afterwards. And so really having that. So let me ask you, what should my child do? You know, so they have this vision statement, they arrive on campus, on a college campus. Now what? What should they do to advocate? And kind of talked a little bit in the beginning about it, but like really, what are some sound ways they have this, they know what they need. Hopefully, like you said, fingers crossed that they've had this in and they're not running triage the month before they're actually supposed to get to college, but it's all laid out. What do they do to advocate? Because now, like you said, they are an adult. And it's all on them.
Yeah, that sounds really scary when you put it.
It does.
And I'm sure any parent listening is like, oh my God, my kid's going to be an adult. How terrified. It'll be okay.
An adult with guidance. There's no expectation that failure, you know, that you have to be perfect and you have to be perfect at adulting. I don't think adults are even perfect at adulting. So I think the expectation is that they can advocate, but knowing that they have a lot of support behind them to help them.
And also part of this is that there's a big learning curve here too. And part of what college does is it gives students that transitional period where they're not quite by themselves. So there's still support structures in place, but those support structures aren't looking for the student. The student has to look for them. So that's kind of the difference, right? So in terms of using your vision statement when you're in college, I would say like for students, it's probably about using it to propel and motivate themselves. So the disability support offices deal with documentation and approving accommodations and implementing accommodations. And so the IEP process, as you may have known it, is not there anymore. There is no IEP process, really.
Right.
There is an interactive process, but there's no team meeting and the parents coming in and the student coming in. The way that it actually looks in college is, you know, your student reaches out to the disability support office to ask them what types of documentation they need to have to support accommodations for their condition. And so when you're looking at schools, you might be connecting with the disability support office ahead of time, which is something that I always recommend that people do if they're considering going to a school, especially if they have a health condition or a physical disability, and even if they have a learning difference or autism, ADD, whatever it is, you want to make sure that those people in the disability support office are going to support you, are going to provide you with the support services that you need to be successful. And you'll get a sense of that when you go in and, for lack of a better way of putting it, interview them. You know,
and I think that's really important. I think having that knowledge that you can interview somebody, and again, kind of asking those questions of, these are my needs, how can you help me support them? And I think then the end result of your experience on that campus is going to be extremely positive, or we would hope, because there's those infrastructures in place to support your needs.
And I think something that catches that people don't often know about is that the admissions process is separate from the disability accommodations process. So you apply to the school, and most people, there's no like checkbox for do you have a disability or not. It's a choice of whether or not you would want to disclose your disability in, you know, a personal essay or to someone affiliated with the school. So you don't have to disclose your disability. It kind of depends on what the students needs are, but they might choose to disclose their disability in their essay, or they might choose not to disclose their disability. And then once they're accepted, they would go through the process of requesting accommodations. But that doesn't mean that you can't talk to the disability support office during that time where you're thinking about whether or not that school is going to be a good fit for you. There's no line between the disability support office and the admissions office. So it's not like people in the disability support office are going to call up the admissions office and say, don't take this person because they have XYZ condition. That would be illegal. So they don't do that.
Right.
Because that would be a huge lawsuit, and universities typically don't look for lawsuits. So that's important for people to know, that you can go in and have a conversation with someone in the disability support office and that it would not impact your admission status to the university, because that's a separate piece of the puzzle. So that's something that sometimes people are a little bit confused about, but it's important for people to go in and talk to the people in the disability support office, because you'll find that different schools have different practices and policies and protocols. One way which, like, kind of the executive function skills and planning skills come into play a lot is, for most universities, if a student needs, let's say, extra time on a test and they've been approved for that accommodation, the student will have to complete a form at least 7 days before they have that exam, bring that to the disability support office to reserve a place to take that exam. And so where students who don't have a really good planning skills and executive function skills sometimes struggle is making those requests, right, in a timely fashion. So most schools will do is, you know, it's 7 days in advance, you have to hand in this form. But if you hand it in late, we may or may not have a place for you to take that exam. And so students sometimes get that, that can be like a tricky piece for some people to navigate. And then the self-advocacy piece kind of comes into play when a student sits down and meets with that disability support counselor or advisor in the disability support office. They'll have to bring in their documentation for their disability. So that's usually depends on the disability, but it could be a neuropsych evaluation or an educational evaluation, typically within the last 3 to 5 years. Most schools want it within the last 3. Most places will not take an IEP as documentation of a disability, so you'll actually have to have the educational testing that went along with that IEP. Most schools also provide all of this information on what the requirements are on their website. So if you're looking at a school, you can just go see, you know, put in disability support and you'll find out what types of documentation are required for your student. If your student has a mental health condition, it could be a letter from their psychologist or psychiatrist. If your student had a chronic health condition, it would be, you know, a letter from their doctor documenting what their functional limitations are and how that might impact them in a college setting, in the classroom setting. So
well, kind of to add to what you're saying, and just thinking that to have that information, but also as you're looking for different colleges, to look at if you have a mental health condition, or that, you know, what doctors, whether it's physical or mental, what doctors, what support are out even outside of the realm of college that is in that surrounding area. So in the event, you know, you're on campus, that you can help provide those advocacy skills for your child and know the resources to contact, you know, who are 5 people on that campus that you could contact in the event that you needed additional support. And kind of have that ahead of time with you, I would think, before you arrive on campus, so that in the moment of something happening, that's not an extra layer or a barrier that you have to face, that you already have a contact for the individual that can help you with the situation that you're experiencing.
Yeah. So part of the work that I do with families, you know, with Accessible College is thinking through that continuity of care piece and making sure that students have the tools and skills so that when they get onto the college campus, they at least know who to talk to or where to go when they're having a situation like you were saying. Because one of the things that's most challenging for students is sometimes they'll find themselves in a jam and not really know what to do about it. And then it becomes a crisis, right? And
so, right. Well, then, especially if, you know, if they're considered of age and they're not, you know, families aren't able to step in and have a conversation with that caring physician that could be supportive of this child, to have that ahead of time before the crisis hits.
Yeah, absolutely. It can really be beneficial. I think once, if you have a student who has these types of needs, once your student is admitted to a school and they've accepted, you're starting that process of requesting accommodations, seeking out who are going to be your healthcare providers in that area too, because that's another thing that, that parents often forget is that, you know, your student might have been seeing this psychologist or psychiatrist locally, but is there someone that they can transition to? Or if your student has a health condition, you know, I work with families who are looking for schools, and part of their planning process is thinking about, you know, is there a medical center either on campus or nearby that I can transfer my child's care needs to? right? So if you have a student who has like significant needs, you know, you might want to talk to your current doctors to say, what other doctors, what other hospital centers or university centers do you have a relationship with already that you would recommend? And sometimes that could be a huge determining factor in figuring out what school is going to be the best fit for your student.
Absolutely. So, and then are you able to get to that doctor, right? So it's not, you know, is there a doctor that can care for you, but they're an hour away from campus, but is it a doctor that can care for you that's easily that you can, you know, take either public transportation or private transportation to get to if you need to?
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of pieces to think through. One of the issues that we had when I worked at Georgetown is that it's just a random thing is that the university doesn't actually allow students to have cars on campus. And so, you know, if you needed to have a car for doctor's appointments or things like that, sitting down and thinking through, like, am I going to be in a city? Can I use a car sharing platform? Do I need to get an accommodation to have the car on campus? Like, there are just a lot of little pieces. And for families, like, you don't know what you don't know.
Right.
And so this is where, like, having someone like me or like you, Wendy, to guide families through that process can be really helpful in making sure that they're thinking about all of those little intricacies. And for me, at least since I've been on the other side of the desk in the college setting, I kind of know like what the process looks like from the inside. You know, the other thing that parents and families parents and families don't often think about housing. That's another big issue that comes up a lot. Like, how is my student who has Crohn's disease or epilepsy or hearing impairment going to be accommodated in a residential setting? So there's a lot of pieces to think through when you're trying to figure out what might be the best housing environment for somebody who has a health condition. And then also like sitting down with a student and thinking through, like, do you want to have a roommate? Do you not? Like, what could this look like? What would be your ideal situation? And that's a vision statement in and of itself, like looping back to that, yeah, right?
That's exactly what I was going to say. Well, just even kind of when you talk about this vision statement for this post-secondary education, for this high school age student that is moving and transitioning to this really big experience for them. And you said, you know, this vision statement board and looking at, you really have pulled through a lot of different elements. So it's not just the academic component that may impact them when they get to college, but what are some other skills, you know, the medication, the medical piece, looking for that doctor in or around the campus area, you know, transportation, looking at that, what do those needs look like for you? You meaning the child, and then the roommate situation, like so what does that look like? If there are bigger needs, medical needs for that student, would it be better if they lived independently? Do they need somebody to help them live independently? You know, can they live with a roommate? What does that look like? And really kind of thinking that through prior to, I can see where that is incredibly valuable. And even prior to just even looking for colleges, because then you can start to really hone in on the college that will best support you globally, physically, emotionally, academically, to really set you up for success as you're learning these bigger life skills.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's absolutely it. And so what I do with families is sit down and think through all of these pieces holistically, because a lot of these things, people tend to think like, oh, if I set my student up for the academic accommodations in college, like that's it, like the boxes have been checked. Not really considering the fact that there's so many other pieces to college life, right. You know, including social life, right? Like, and programmatic accessibility, you know, and thinking through, you know, if your kid has diabetes and you know that they might be out drinking or what does that look like? And having those kind of briny, uncomfortable conversations. Which I get to have a lot, but it's good because then we're thinking through all of the pieces, right? We're thinking through like, okay, if you're making this choice, what tools do you have in your toolbox? And thinking through like why you might be making that choice or how you might think about making a different choice.
Well, instead of then getting to a moment, whether it is, you know, a choice that you make independently, but just setting yourself up for success, having those resources available so that you've practiced the language. You know, there may be things that you have a response to your needs for another individual. You don't necessarily have to share your whole medical history, but you have a response to individuals and you can share what you're comfortable with. So practicing that ahead of time would make that less awkward for that individual when they're face to face with that situation.
Yeah. I mean, and that's a great point you bring up. when a student is approved for accommodations in college, say they've been approved for extra time on tests, they maybe get flexibility in attendance, maybe they have a note taker, they then get a piece of paper or an email goes out to the professor. So if they get a piece of paper, they have to bring that piece of paper to the professor and have a conversation about their accommodations. And then the professor would sign that paper and the student has to return it back to the disability support office. Some schools have gone electronic. So then an email would be sent to the professor and the professor electronically signs it. But I always tell students, it's important for professors to know you and to know what your needs are. And they shouldn't know you because you're failing out of the class or not coming to class. They should know you because you're being proactive and having a conversation with them. I typically tell students to go to the office hours and have a conversation with the professor, introduce themselves, say, you know, this is me. These are the accommodations I have, and have a conversation about what that's going to look like. So if you have a chronic health condition that has a lot of flare-ups, you know, you would say to the professor, I have this accommodation for flexibility and attendance. I don't anticipate having to use it, but if I do, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to email you. I'm going to do this, this, and this, and we're going to figure out how to make up that work. And it's a conversation with the professor about what that accommodation looks like, as opposed to not having that conversation with the professor and then just sending them an email and saying, I'm not coming to class today. And then the professor's like, what? What's going on with the student? And then it becomes a super challenging situation. So it's good for students to be able to talk about what their needs are ahead of time. A lot of what I do too is rehearse with students like what these conversations may look like for them and may feel like, because right now, if your student's in high school, the high school teachers all know what the accommodation is. And theoretically, they are all providing the accommodation, you know, as it is stipulated in the IEP. But when you're in college, a critical thing for families to understand too is that professors are not always trained educators. So they may be experts in their field, in physics or in theology or English, but they might not be empathetic and understanding to your child's needs.
Right. And so that's even more important with the vision statement to kind of start to pick out these areas and then take it that step further and practice what's happening. And we kind of threaded through this whole talk that we're having here and just trying to expose your student to what that's going to look like and what that's going to feel like. I really think that's a really good point that you made in terms of in a calm environment with no pressure, role playing, so you can kind of get some of those nerves out of the way and then be able to say, this is what I'm going to do about it. And these are, you know, and that really empowers that student. And at the end of the day, you know, Annie, that's what you do with Accessible College. That's what we do with Learning Essentials, is looking at how can we empower the child to be more successful? How can we empower, you know, from my end, because I do work with that K through 12, how can we empower the families to make it a good day so that they then have this information to transfer over to Accessible College and empower themselves independently to be successful? So I really appreciate all this information that you've shared. It's just a treasure for parents to listen to be able to start that journey at any age of creating that vision statement for a child of where do you see them in a year? Where do you see them in 5 years? Brainstorming with either outside professionals or individuals on that educational team, that IEP team, of what's appropriate and how we can get our child to that end goal and how to have them be the biggest advocates for themselves and to be most successful. So Annie, I really appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks, Wendy.
Thank you so much for joining us today in the IEP Essentials Pro Tip Podcast. And that's again brought to you by Learning Essentials. I am your host, Wendy Taylor. If you want more regarding vision statements, our in-depth parent IEP prep webinar for vision statements will provide details on how and when and why to create your own vision statements. It's really more of that individual approach and how to do that and providing tools.